trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. This program is all about encouraging you to think clearly and independently about the world around us. In other words, my disclaimer is this: I don't have all the answers. I'm not smart, I'm not rich, I'm not good looking. Frankly, I myself am wondering what the heck I'm doing here sitting behind this microphone talking to people. But I am definitely a person who places great value on truth and understanding that to do that, you got to be willing to do your own homework. You got to be willing to dig and sometimes, be brave enough to encounter things that challenge what you already understand and what you already know. So if that's the kind of courage that you're bringing to the table, then by all means, make yourself comfortable. Come and revel in wrong thinking. Let's see if we can learn a thing or two together. Again, it's not about you having to agree with me, but I'm going to do my best to offer you some insights on what's going on around us that if they don't convince you that this is the proper way to see things, at the very least will give you a broader perspective from which to size up what's going on all around us. Our program is brought to you in part by lifesavingfood.com. I've talked for years about the importance of food storage, emergency preparedness, self-reliance. Life-saving food is one of those ways that you can do this. They not only have great shelf-stable, like 25-year shelf life food storage available in big or small packages, whatever it is that you find yourself in need of, but they also have wonderful self-reliance packages, including ways to purify your water, ways to cook your food, alternative means of cooking. It's all about having options. If you want to make sure you have options in case things get a little bit tricky, like for instance, they're getting in Sri Lanka at the moment, lifesavingfood.com would be a great place to start. Well, for all the posturing from the president on down, there is no data supporting the threat of white supremacy that is being blasted at us nonstop. In fact, one of the things, I guess the memo went out over the last couple of days about, well, you know, anybody who talks about great replacement theory, and the simplest form I've heard of this is that, okay, one of the things that the Biden administration seems to be very fond of is allowing people unfettered access to this country via our southern border, and then taking those undocumented immigrants, I could say illegal aliens, but you get the picture, and basically busing them all over the country, distributing them to different cities. And I think that there is purpose behind that, and probably a good portion of that purpose is we're trying to get voters in place to make sure that we have the numbers so we don't have to work so hard to steal like we did in the last election. Oops, was that the out loud part? But every time you hear them talk about, well, you know, if people are espousing this great replacement theory, well, that's nothing more than a racist theory. This is what the headlines have been saying here lately. Before we go to Julie Kelly's article about how no data supports the threat of white supremacy, I want to play for you a few dangerous demagogues, notable because these are all coming from the political left, talking about great replacement theory. So if you think the Republicans are full of racism, check out some of these folks on the left talking about the same exact thing.
It seems harder and harder to ignore that the echoes of replacement theory and other racially motivated views are increasingly coming out into the open.
In a few years, we're going to be a majority brown country. White people will not be the majority in the country anymore.
This will be the first generation ever in American history in which whites will be a minority of the generation at some point.
As of 2007, every year, babies being born in this country, whites now are the minority.
In 2044, everyone is going to be a minority.
As the demographics change, as white people become the minority in the country, which is coming.
Demographics is destiny.
Demographics is destiny.
Demographics is destiny, right? The country is changing.
I've been saying it here. Other people have been saying it here for years now, even before Donald Trump. The demographics is destiny.
The white population is declining for the first time in history in America, while the number of multiracial Americans have more than doubled.
So we live in a country where the demographics are changing. It's becoming less white.
Correct.
Okay. You'll be announcing that we're calling the 38 electoral votes of Texas for the Democratic nominee for president. It's changing. It's going to become a purple state and then a blue state because of the demographics, because of the population growth.
The growth in Texas has been almost entirely driven by non-white population growth, mostly by Hispanic and Latino population growth.
The idea that whites will not be the majority, I mean, it's an exciting transformation of the country. It's an exciting evolution and progress of our country in many different ways.
The white population is declining. It was always on the upswing. So that speaks to the beautiful diversity of America. It speaks to how that population will, the demographics will weigh in politically.
I believe anybody who echoes a replacement is to blame, not for this particular crime, but it's for no purpose except profit and or political benefit. And it's wrong. It's just simply wrong.
What a bunch of racists. Oh, my goodness. Nah, it doesn't feel any better calling them the things that they're calling everybody else on the right. But yeah, those are all very prominent left-wing or Democratic leaders spreading that to great replacement theory. Just another illustration of why anything that is coming at you from the mainstream media has to be questioned seriously, doubted openly, and oftentimes rejected. So let's jump into Julie Kelly's article, No Data Supports Threat of White Supremacists. The subheadline here, Joe Biden will use the blood of innocents to paint millions of Americans as white supremacists and wannabe terrorists simply for supporting the opposite political party. This was written earlier this week where Julie Kelly says Joe Biden will travel to Buffalo on Tuesday, and he did, ostensibly to join the upstate New York community in mourning the murders of 10 people at a local grocery store over the weekend. Now, she says it is, of course, appropriate for Biden in his role as president to grieve with Americans devastated by such a brutal massacre of innocents, especially an attack that, from all accounts, was racially motivated. What's not appropriate is for Biden to use the atrocity as a platform to fuel even more hatred and division in a country ripping apart at the seams in so many ways. But that's exactly what he will do. And she's right. It's exactly what he did. The man who launched his 2020 campaign for president, touting the lie that Donald Trump commended very fine white supremacists after a 2017 protest in Charlottesville, can be expected to promote another lie, and that is that violent white supremacists and domestic extremists pose a heightened threat to the country. Now, that tired mantra remains an animating feature of the Biden regime. On his second full day in office, Biden instructed his national security team to devise a whole-of-government approach to combat domestic terrorism, largely using the events of January 6, 2021 as the pretext. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki promised a facts-based analysis upon which we can shape policy when she announced that initiative on January 22nd of 2021. But the 32-page report issued by Merrick Garland's Justice Department during a public ceremony in June was long on rhetoric and very short on facts. And by the way, Julie Kelly has been one of the best voices in documenting the government's missteps and overreach in terms of January 6th. Just FYI. She says, while noting mass shootings committed by white men in Charleston, Pittsburgh, and El Paso, the analysis failed to prove what it described as a persistent and emerging threat of domestic terrorism. Now, the authors also claimed the victims of the U.S. Capitol joined the tragic history of American terror attacks, including the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, which killed 168 people, including children. Further, the unrelated handful of acts took place over a six-year period, hardly representing of a systemic pattern of white-on-black violence. Horrible and sickening? Yes. Carnage that merits the harshest punishment possible for the perpetrators? Yes. But is it representative of a pervasive threat requiring the use of intrusive government and private sector surveillance tools once reserved for foreign terrorists? Julie Kelly says no. Of course, domestic violent extremist or white supremacist is political code for Trump supporters. What else could explain the report's omission of violent extremists associated with Black Lives Matter or Antifa? It's not an accident that on the one-year anniversary of the most destructive riots in the nation's history, Biden's missive failed to make a single mention of the damage, death, or nationwide campaign of terror unleashed in the aftermath of George Floyd's death in 2020. No matter how hard Democrats, the news media, and establishment Republicans like U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, who blamed Republican House leaders on Monday morning for enabling white nationalism and white supremacy, no matter how they try to twist the matter, the data simply does not support these accusations. The most current figures are available from 2020, one of the most tumultuous years in U.S. history. And rather than telling the story of a country under siege by bloodthirsty white supremacists, the metrics, if accurate, and that's a big if, considering the designation of a hate crime is based on the subjective determination of the charging agency, they all contradict the narrative. With more than 15,000 local law enforcement agencies reporting, the FBI tallied 8,263 hate crime incidents for 2020. Is the light starting to come on? We'll come back to Julie Kelly's article, just the other side of these messages. Please stay with us.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm sharing with you an article from Julie Kelly. This is from AmericanGreatness.com or AmGreatness.com. No data supports the threat of white supremacists, which it turns out is now kind of a code word, at least for the president and his administration and many within the media and on the political left, for anyone who isn't in lockstep with them. That's kind of convenient, isn't it? Right? We can safely dispense with half the country, or at least half the country, that doesn't agree with their agenda. Why? Because they're all racists. And yet, the data doesn't show that our country somehow has been under siege by bloodthirsty white supremacists. In fact, Julie Kelly says roughly half, according to the FBI's Crime Data Explorer, of the 8,263 hate crime incidents for 2020 were motivated by anti-black or anti-African American sentiment. And of the 4,082 offenses against blacks in 2020, you know what the top offense was? Intimidation. A little more than 1,200 offenses were for assault. Only 5 were categorized as murder or manslaughter. And 1,710 out of 2,353 perpetrators were white. So racially motivated crime would be non-existent in an ideal world, but she says that's not the world in which we live, particularly as the ruling class, corporate news organizations, and social media platforms bang the drums of a race war on a daily basis. The individual cases may be troubling, but in no way do they incriminate an entire race or political party, much less do they support the narrative of a rampant white supremacist crime spree. Now, Julie Kelly says information from the Justice Department is even more unconvincing. On its hate crime homepage, the agency listed 30 examples of federal hate crimes for 2021. Of the 9 offenses related to race, 4 took place in 2021. The rest occurred in previous years but were adjudicated in 2021, so hardly a compelling trove of evidence for a department attempting to persuade the public that dangerous white supremacists are ready to strike at any moment. Now, more specific data isn't forthcoming. Overall crime statistics for 2021, including racially motivated crimes, may not be made available to the public this year. That's a timely gift to the Democrats as voters continue to list crime as their top concern ahead of the 2022 midterm elections. Since the FBI switched to a new reporting system, many local law enforcement entities are opting out of the voluntary program, bringing the agency participation well below the mandatory 60% threshold. The FBI already skipped the first quarterly report of 2022, usually issued in late March. And if participation doesn't increase, there's a chance subsequent reports will be missed too. How convenient. Julie Kelly says there is, of course, a more political reason why the FBI won't release crime statistics from last year. And it's because the results will contradict the administration. According to an independent analysis of 36 police departments, hate crimes rose by 39% in the nation's largest cities in 2021. With the top 10 metropolitan areas reporting a staggering 54% increase over 2020. But hold on to your hat. That rise is due to a huge uptick in hate crimes against Asians and Jews. Data crunched by the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, shows a 224% increase in anti-Asian hate crimes, a 58% increase in anti-Jewish hate crimes, and a 51% increase in anti-gay hate crimes. News reports out of major cities support the data, with a wave of recent attacks in Dallas that has the city's Asian business community in a panic. Police are now looking for a black man suspected of shooting three Korean women at a hair salon last week. But she says Joe Biden will not discuss any of those facts during his trip to Buffalo on Tuesday. Instead, Biden will rage against an imaginary menace. He will blame Republicans and Fox News. He'll demand more stringent measures, including online censorship, to prevent another attack. Biden will use the blood of innocents to paint millions of Americans as white supremacists and wannabe terrorists simply for supporting the other political party. Rather than comfort the heartbroken loved ones, Biden will exploit their loss for his own gratification. There is no stoop too low for old Joe. So says Julie Kelly. That's a pretty solid take right there. All right, I'm going to shift gears here for a moment. Something a little bit lighter. There is something that's incredibly freeing about not needing the approval of other people. Why am I sharing this with you? Because if you are determined to be a person who lives by truth and who stands up for truth, basically becomes a source of light in an ever-darkening world, you're not going to get the approval of other people. In fact, you're probably going to get a lot of disapproval. That's the price of standing for something. Jonathan Barnes has a great article about being a weirdo in an upside-down culture. He says you're going to have to be comfy being a bit weird if you want to be free. Jonathan Barnes says, I'm what you might call an eccentric. I've been labeled as different, wild, strange, crazy, wacko, a weirdo, a freak, a clown, an idiot, and a few other not-so-nice names. And he says, I plead guilty to some of these charges, and I must confess that at least some of the time I do things that may appear strange to others, such as being a straight man who cooks, who loves gardening and landscaping, and who has a slacker's tendency not to get his hair cut for months. I'm the stranger who plays Johnny Cash gospel music loudly on Sundays as if by religious rite, who talks out loud to the neighbor cat hanging out on his front porch, and who digs footstool-sized rocks out of the woods across the street to use in the yard. He says today, far more than in recent memory, we need eccentrics and lots of them. So, how do you know that you're an eccentric? Well, you might be one if you believe that a dress-wearing man cannot transform himself into a real live woman. You might be one if you believe your ancestors aren't evil for having white skin. And you also might be one if you think your parents were good people or that U.S. troops going on foreign ventures hurts the little guy and our own country. Jonathan Barnes says eccentric cranks weirdly insist that it's criminal to allow millions of illegal workers to be imported to steal the rightful jobs of American citizens, saving some rich employers money, while drastically depressing workers' wages overall and making it harder for many Americans just to get by. Such eccentrics demand that citizens have a right to be protected from this evil, which they insist could be defeated by a government that enforces its immigration laws. In essence, if you are what was once a normal person, you are now an eccentric. Because these days, the obvious commonsensical things that we all used to know are no longer commonly understood. Now he says, me? I don't have a problem with being thought of as an oddball. I figure it comes with the territory as I'm a loner anyway. But many of my countrymen don't feel as comfortable going against the grain, largely because they have steady jobs and fear being fired for their views. Tough luck, lads and lassies. You're going to have to get comfy with being a bit weird if you want to be free. You're going to have to go against the grain and speak up in opposition to the party line, presenting the argument in such a way that others can understand the real truth. He has a great quote here from John Stuart Mill on these eccentrics and society's need for them in his 1859 work On Liberty. Quote, in this age, the mere example of nonconformity, the mere refusal to bend the knee to custom, is itself a service. Precisely because the tyranny of opinion is such as to make eccentricity a reproach, it is desirable in order to break through that tyranny that people should be eccentric. Eccentricity has always abounded when and where strength of character has abounded, and the amount of eccentricity in a society has generally been proportional to the amount of genius, mental vigor, and moral courage which it contained. That so few now dare to be eccentric marks the chief danger of the time. End quote. That is such a great quote. Jonathan Barnes says, to dispel any doubt in those inclined to take my advice and as an encouraging reminder of their worth, I have an affirmation. Please repeat after me. I'm not a domestic terrorist, nor am I a hater. I'm a truth-telling, freedom-loving, lovable, old, eccentric. And he says, nowadays, the biggest weirdos of all are those with the nerve to tell the truth out loud. I think he's right. And I hope it hits you the same way that it hit me. And that is that, first of all, we're not alone. And secondly, I'm okay with being thought of as a weirdo. I look around me and I see that my fellow weirdos, our numbers may be few, but I'm not concerned with the numbers so much as, am I doing the right thing? Am I clinging to the truth as I should? That's got to be the priority over just simply gaining the approval of the crowd.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. The Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage has been one of my longtime sponsors and supporters. And I'm so grateful to Heather and all that she has done. You know, watching the influx of people into the Intermountain West has been something truly amazing to see. And it's been curious to see the effect that it's had on the real estate market. I mean, we have been living in one of the hottest real estate markets most of us have ever seen in our lifetime. And that means when a home goes on the market, it gets snapped up right away. And that means that you don't have time to waste if you are shopping for a home or trying to get a mortgage. Well, this is where the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage can help you. Heather has decades of experience in the lending industry. She clearly understands what the lenders need. She understands what the borrowers need. She's the one you want on your side to make things happen when time is of the essence. To reach her, you can call 435-703-4522. Click on the email link I provide in my show notes under sponsors for the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. Heather's NMLS ID is 715386, and Patriot Home Mortgage is an equal housing opportunity lender. Well, when it comes to Orwellian manipulation of our language, the New York Times has once again raised the bar. Got a great piece here from Tyler Durden on ZeroHedge.com. This was actually republished on LouRockwell.com earlier today about the New York Times blasted for writing Ukrainian fighters were evacuated, but they never once used the word surrender, talking about what was happening at the Azovstal metalworks facility in Ukraine. Tyler Durden says, the New York Times is coming under heavy criticism for announcing the end of the lengthy Russian siege of the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol with the below tweet and headline, which says, breaking news, Ukraine ended its combat mission in Mariupol and said fighters were being evacuated, signaling that the battle at a steel plant was over. Really? Now, objectively, they were evacuated to Russian-controlled territory by Russian forces and the wounded taken to a Russian-controlled hospital. So the paper of record actually just managed to completely avoid the reality that some 300 Azov militants surrendered instead of opting to suggest that somehow Ukraine's forces decided to wind down their combat mission. And the headline also emphasized they were being evacuated. But then awkwardly, the very first sentence of the Monday Times report indicated after they laid down their arms, the fighters were taken into Russian custody and transferred to pro-Kremlin territory, specifically to Novoazovsk. Wow. In the Donetsk People's Republic. So again, they were evacuated, in quotation marks, by their Russian enemies who've captured them. Some nice spin there, New York Times, but I think you've been called on it. The New York Times report said hundreds of Ukrainian fighters were taken by bus to Russian-controlled territory. Ukraine's president said the combat mission in the city was over, capping some of the longest, fiercest resistance. Now, by any objective observer's assessment, the surrounded Ukrainians holed up in the cavernous facility for 2 months with nowhere to exit, finally surrendered on Monday. Yet the paper of record, along with a slew of other mainstream media, presented that somehow it was a Ukrainian mission accomplished moment.
Here's a quote from Hannah Mallier, saying Mariupol's defenders have fully accomplished all missions assigned by the command, adding that it was impossible to unblock Azovstal by military means. Now, some social media commenters noted that the New York Times has turned Orwellian newspeak into an art form. A.J. Delgado says, so the Russians won in Mariupol, took Mariupol, and the Ukrainians lost despite heaps of weapons from all over the world and foreign fighters. Would be nice if you could keep us updated with actual facts. Many others have pointed out the Azov Battalion's long-established unabashed neo-Nazi ideology, which has for years been exhaustively documented, but it's all but disappeared from acknowledgement in mainstream media. I like how Moon of Alabama puts it in this tweet. Reality. Mariupol. Azov Nazis taken prisoners after unconditional surrender to Russian forces. And of course, journalist Michael Tracy warns of the dangerous pattern of concerning such obvious narrative bias when major outlets purport to present the facts regarding a complex, rapidly changing war where few correspondents are actually on the ground in battle zones. Michael Tracy said, this is why you have to assume that pretty much everything coming out of Western media about the tactical progression of the war is a distortion. They're operating within an impenetrable superstructure of ideology that prevents the New York Times from labeling this a surrender. Now, I get this is kind of a touchy subject for a lot of people, especially people who are right now very deep in the grip of fear over Russia and all things Russian. The fact that I'm saying, well, you know what, in this case, the New York Times is lying out of their, you know, nether regions to try to portray this as somehow this is a positive thing. And yes, why, you know, they've declared a victory and gone home is what's happened here, when that's clearly not the case. I'm not taking sides. I'm not cheering on the Russian troops. I'm not cheering on the Ukrainian troops either. What? You're not standing with Ukraine? That's right. I'm not. It's not my circus. It's not my monkeys. I feel deep sympathy for the people who are caught in the middle in this conflict, and there are a lot of innocent people who are suffering greatly as a result of this military conflict. But I'm also very keenly aware that with this military conquest and with this military action, which is being actively egged on and escalated by the West, by our friends in NATO, yeah, I'm not going to be a supporter for any of those things. Who was it? I think it was the Libertarian Party in New Hampshire. Tweeted this a couple of days ago. I guess it was yesterday. NATO exists to manage the risks created by its existence. Let me read that one more time. NATO exists to manage the risks created by its existence. And I know there are people who are very heavily invested in the idea, but we're the good guys. We are the good guys. Or good or bad, when our troops are in harm's way or when our, you know, allies are in harm's way, or we have a duty to shut up and go along with it. Now, I reject that. I'm not giving aid and comfort to the enemy, and I'm not going to pretend that what NATO is doing is somehow in my best interest. No matter how many American advisors or how much support, you know, Congress may be happening to send to them. Not going to do it. I do see this as a very solid opportunity to point out how the truth can be manipulated. The subtlety, the sophistry with which the New York Times goes about reporting this. I mean, for crying out loud. Ukraine ended its combat mission in Mariupol and said fighters were being evacuated, signaling the battle at a steel plant was over. I mean, if all you do is read the headlines or just look at the tweet and, oh, well, it looks like that resolved well and good for them. But it doesn't begin to tell the real story, which is that after a couple of months of being under siege, they surrendered to Russian forces and were taken into custody. I've seen pictures and I've seen video of some of the people that were taken into custody, and I'll tell you, there are some very unhappy faces, and it's not because, well, they were just defending their homeland against Russian aggression. The unhappy faces I'm seeing are the faces of people who have had since 2014 to essentially go on a rampage against the Russian-speaking people in this breakaway region or this region seeking independence from Ukraine, and who have been absolutely horrific and committed numerous atrocities. Now, does that mean the Russians are good and right in everything they do? Not at all. But it does mean that some people who've behaved in absolutely animalistic ways on the Ukrainian side are very likely going to face justice for what they've done. Doesn't it suck that we can't really point to, well, who are the good guys in this? Near as I can tell, there really are no good guys. And that goes far beyond just the Russians and the Ukrainians. I should say the Russian and Ukrainian governments. To the extent that NATO is getting involved, to the extent that NATO is supplying more and more weapons and trying to enlarge and further encourage and drag out this conflict, they're not the good guys either. The fact that they're doing it with your tax dollars and my tax dollars, that doesn't mean that you and I have a dog in this fight either. That just means we're being fleeced to help perpetuate atrocities being committed on the other side of the world. How does this all shake out? I don't know. But I'll tell you right now, I'm very concerned with the direction that it's going, because I think there is a degree of hubris and malevolence in most of the political leaders that they would be more than willing to go ahead and start World War III, including a nuclear exchange for the sake of covering up their crimes, especially of these last couple of years, in relation to COVID, vaccines, lockdowns, etc. You have to admit, it does a marvelous job of keeping our attention off the leadership and on, you know, their purported bad guys. I'm just asking you to consider if there might be something we're missing here.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Once again, thanks for being a part of my growing audience of wrong thinkers. If you want to subscribe to my show notes, I would encourage you go to thebrianhydeshow.com. Click on the show notes any day. It doesn't matter. Scroll down to the bottom. You'll see a nice subscribe button. Just drop in your email. I'll send you a copy of those show notes every single day that I do the show. Also want to thank HSLAmmo.com for being one of my sponsors. Spencer Worthington is one of the finest human beings that I know. He is the founder and director of HSL Ammo. And this is a guy who has built this company from the ground up. He did not inherit it. He did not walk into a perfectly ready-made situation. He did it the old-fashioned way through entrepreneurial hard work and vision. And he's doing well. And if you want to avail yourself of ammunition for the purpose of, you know, going out and having fun, making a joyous noise for freedom, or developing your skills, or for that matter, just putting your money into a commodity that will hold value regardless of what the dollar happens to be doing, HSLAmmo.com is the place I would point you. Well, have you noticed how the more activists insist that LGBTQ indoctrination isn't taking place in our government schools, the more they also push back against any effort to establish clear boundaries against it being promoted in our schools? Curious how that works. Got a great article here from Andrew Doyle on how to stop children from being indoctrinated. Now, Andrew Doyle is he's the comedian and the creator of the Twitter persona Tatiana McGrath. And if you have not seen this on Twitter, it's one of the best parody accounts that you will ever see. But he's also got a solid take here. He says, during one of the morning assemblies at my convent school, our headmistress, a fearsome nun who beat me with a shoe for accidentally breaking a window, announced that there was to be an amnesty on Garbage Pail Kids trading stickers. Do you remember these things? She was convinced that these grotesque caricatures would have a corrupting influence on our impressionable minds. And so, one by one, we shuffled up to the stage, faces hot with humiliation, before ripping up our precious stickers and depositing the remains in a metallic bowl. And he says, I was reminded of this curious ritual when I read recently of the flame purification ceremony conducted by the board in charge of elementary and secondary schools in southwestern Ontario. Almost 5,000 books judged to contain outdated racial stereotypes were removed from school libraries to be burnt or recycled. I guess if you want to be an environmentally conscious book burner, You recycle them. Some of the incinerated remains were used as fertilizer to plant a tree, an uplifting, progressive, and environmentally conscious gesture, if one ignores the overtones of Fahrenheit 451. Now, Andrew Doyle says, perhaps it's unsurprising that activists who are convinced that language causes real-world harm should be troubled by the reading habits of children. After all, it's hardly a fringe view. The Center for Teaching and Learning at the University of Cambridge this month suggested that Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie series ought to come with content notes. That's a substitute phrase for trigger warnings, given that the word trigger connotes violence and might therefore induce trauma. He says this fear that children might be morally corrupted by problematic literature might explain the sudden deluge of progressive children's books on the market, just as children are deemed so malleable that they might transform into bigots if they read outdated work. It's assumed that they can be indoctrinated in the correct way if their reading materials are layered with the messaging that reinforces the creed of social justice. As Schopenhauer put it, there is no absurdity so palpable but that it may be firmly implanted in the human head if you only begin to inculcate it by before the age of five. The rise of progressive children's books arguably began in 2016 with Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls by Elena Favilli and Francesca Cavallo. The idea was a charming one. It contained profiles of exceptional women throughout history offered up as role models for young readers. And examples included Michelle Obama, Maya Angelou, Yoko Ono, even Coco Chanel, whose collaboration with the Nazis was tactfully omitted. Thereafter, the tone of such books became more strident. There was Feminist Baby by Lauren Brantz, Anti-Racist Baby by Ibram X. Kendi, and The Little Girl Who Gave Zero Fs by Amy Keene. All of a sudden, highly dubious ideological positions were being represented as uncontested truth to very young children. Nor was this confined to America. Last summer, the National Education Union, the largest teaching union in the United Kingdom, claimed there was an urgent need to decolonize every subject and every stage of the school curricula and called for activist training for teachers. But it's not simply a matter of race. Books aimed at toddlers which advance the idea that they have a gendered soul are also being promoted by activist teachers and authors. For instance, Who Are You? The Kid's Guide to Gender Identity by Brooke Pessin Wedby is marketed for children as young as three and introduces them to identity categories well beyond the comprehension of most adults, including genderqueer, non-binary, bigender, and two-spirit. Or consider the following claim from It Feels Good to Be Yourself, a book about gender identity by Teresa Thorne, next to an illustration of a newborn baby. Quote, "See, when you were born, you couldn't tell people who you were or how you felt. They looked at you and made a guess. Maybe they got it right. Maybe they got it wrong." So Thorne, it seems, wants children to believe that for years, midwives and obstetricians have simply been flipping a coin and randomly assigning male or female on birth certificates. Now, Andrew Doyle says this is, of course, palpably absurd. And yet it would be wrong-headed to call for such books to be censored or banned. The vast majority of educators understand how ridiculous it is to teach infants that they have a gendered soul or that they are guilty of white privilege. Last year, the Arizona Department of Education released an equity toolkit, which claimed that even babies as young as 3 months old are capable of racial prejudice. Now, he says, "I remain unconvinced that any of this has much of an effect." As one teacher recently said to him, "Teachers are more prone to fashionable nonsense than pupils. Trust the kids. They know BS when they see it." But what of the younger ones, those who tend to accept and repeat the mantras of their elders? Andrew Doyle says it's unlikely to be a coincidence that the emergence of such activism in the classroom has brought with it a sudden rise of young people identifying as non-binary or transgender. Now, some of these children will doubtless be suffering from a form of gender dysphoria, but most will find such confusions resolved through the natural process of puberty. When children as young as 3 and 4 are coming out as trans, are we not right to be suspicious that adult influence has played a role? As trans YouTuber Blair White said, a transgender 3-year-old is like a vegan cat. We all know who's making the lifestyle choices. Few parents have grasped the significance of these developments, largely because these attempts at indoctrination have been couched in progressive terminology. One exception is Wales, where the government is currently being sued by more than 5,000 parents and grandparents over their decision to make compulsory the teaching of gender identity and sexual attraction to kids as young as three. The government has apparently adopted Stonewall's misinterpretation of the Equality Act and have accordingly substituted gender identity for gender reassignment in its equality and diversity policy. Now, it may be that the Welsh government is breaking the law. Section 406 of the Education Act of 1996 prohibits the promotion of partisan political views in the teaching of any subject. And this applies to not only political belief systems like Marxism, but also ideological frameworks like critical race theory. In October 2020, the Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch, addressed Parliament to clarify the government's position. She said, "We do not want to see teachers teaching their white pupils about white privilege and inherited racial guilt. And let me be clear, any school which teaches these elements of critical race theory as fact, or which promotes partisan political views such as defunding the police without offering a balanced treatment of opposing views, is breaking the law." If she's right, it's difficult to see how the teaching of gender identity ideology as undisputed truth could be exempt from these legal requirements. Now, he says, "It remains to be seen whether current and future legal challenges make any difference. In the meantime, criticism and mockery are by far our best defense. Take the recent controversy regarding the success of Matt Walsh's new book, Johnny the Walrus. It tells the story of Johnny, a boy who enjoys pretending to be a walrus by using spoons as tusks. The online community mobilizes and tells him he must either choose between being a walrus or being a human, and he cannot be both. In response, hysterical staff at Amazon held a meeting to discuss the trauma the book had caused. Executives are even heard strategizing about how to demote the title on their website to limit potential sales. So, no books were burnt, but the underlying rationale was the same. Namely, that indoctrination of the young is always a temptation for those whose ideas would not withstand adult scrutiny. But as Walsh's book proves, the idea that small children are in any way interested in intersectional activism is inherently funny, and mockery is always the best way to expose the falsehoods of powerful elites. Andrew Doyle says, "If there's one thing the high priests of this new religion cannot bear, it is the sound of laughter." I would have to agree. And I'm not talking about we should be looking for every opportunity to mock and ridicule people who think differently than we do. I do think that maintaining a sense of humor, though, is helpful, and keeping a sense of perspective as well. And I think humor is far more helpful than anger or hatred. Now, your mileage may vary, but for what it's worth, that's my take.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.